I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, there's more major news about women's health today, and it follows right on the heels of recommendations earlier this week that women in their 40s don't need to have mammograms. Today, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is saying most women don't need annual pap smears. The group says younger women ending up getting unnecessarily or sometimes potentially harmful follow-up procedures because of abnormal pap smear results. Dr. Sherelle Iglesia helped write the guidelines. And Dr. Iglesia, walk us through exactly what the recommendations are.
Well, the long and short of it is that the new recommendations are to start later and to end earlier. We basically are recommending that women begin screening pap smears or cervical cytology at age 21. And we're going to end somewhere between age 65 to 70.
And the earlier thinking was that women should start having pap smears at age 18.
Well, we've had several recommendations through the years. One is at the onset of sexual intercourse. And we've also had most recently recommended 3 years after sexual debut. But the risk for invasive cervical cancer in your teens, early 20s, is extremely remote. And the potential for harm outweighs, you know, any kind of benefit or gain that you would get in picking up that earlier cancer.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, but I wanted to ask, so the suggestion is to begin having pap smears at age 21 and then not every year after that?
No, age 21 and every 2 years up until age 30.
And then,
at age 30, if you have a normal cytology and a normal DNA test for the HPV, you can space that out to every 3 years.
So an HPV, the human papilloma virus, is the virus which is known to cause cervical cancer, which is why the pap smear tests for the presence of HPV in a woman's reproductive system. But you were saying earlier that the risk of cervical cancer or HPV turning into cervical cancer isn't as high as was thought before?
Well, there is a great exposure to HPV. The issue is that most of that is not going to advance to cancer. And so we don't need to over-treat, particularly in our teen population, because it can lead to harm in terms of down-the-road issues with women not being able to hold pregnancies full term or developing some scar tissue along the cervix and what's called cervical stenosis.
Let me ask you, what you're saying is that it's not necessarily the pap smear itself that could cause the future problems with pregnancy. It's procedures that come after a positive pap smear is discovered.
I think it relates to the angst in the patient, and then there may be a reaction that we need to do something about this when the majority of it, of this HPV, is going to actually regress. Back to normal. It's going to disappear.
Okay, and so when you say that there may be something that we have to do about it, these are these follow-up biopsies and medical procedures to treat the HPV?
Like LEAPS, which are loop electrical excision procedures of the cervix, or cones, that removes portions of the cervix that can have, you know, in a young woman, when they eventually become pregnant, can lead to some issues.
So the LEAP procedure or these cone biopsies remove a portion of the cervix that could be infected with HPV or be precancerous. Is that
correct?
Right? So instead of recommending that women don't get pap smears every year when it's the pap that's not necessarily the problem, why not recommend that doctors hold off on doing the LEAP procedure or the cone biopsy?
Yeah, I think that the issue is that the incidence is so low in women in their teens that, you know, our potential for harm is going to just greatly outweigh this, including, you know, the harm that we get with the angst of having knowing that you have something abnormal.
I have to ask you, though, the pap smear is a very simple, low-cost screening technique used by doctors. It's been shown to be extremely effective, as maybe too effective in detecting whether or not a woman has the human papilloma virus. In other words, it's an incredibly effective screen for cervical cancer. I mean, isn't this kind of low-cost, effective preventative medicine the kind of thing we should actually be doing more of and not less of?
Well, we're not really talking about cost here. What we are really focusing on is the best for women's health and the prevention of harm when you end up over-treating these conditions.
So there's a lot of focus on women's health right now. And do you feel that there's a possibility that there could be a backlash against these recommendations regarding pap smears?
You know, I feel that, you know, first, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists did not sign on to the mammogram recommendations, and we feel that the Pap smear screening is different in that the evidence for the potential for harm is very compelling, and we feel that most patients and most practitioners will actually concur.
That's Dr. Sherelle Iglesia, who helped write the new guidelines for Pap smears. We're going to take a break from the news on this Friday to revisit a conversation from earlier this year. It starts with the small town of Oxford, Iowa, and a letter the residents there received in April of 1984.
Dear neighbor, during the month of May, I'm going to be working on a project to photograph everyone in Oxford. I will be contacting you during these next couple of weeks to set up appointments. We would like you to dress as you are, not as you might look in your Sunday best. Thank you, and I hope to see you soon.
That's Peter Feldstein. He wrote the letter, and he set up a makeshift studio in town and took pictures of nearly all of Oxford's approximately 700 residents. Homemakers, factory workers, husband and wife Ford dealers, truck drivers, the mayor, doctors, college students, railroad workers, and children. Peter took their pictures and exhibited them in town, then put them away in a drawer. That's where they stayed until 2005, when a friend and fellow University of Iowa professor saw the photos and convinced Peter to re-photograph Oxford's residents. The side-by-side, then-and-now photos, plus new interviews, were published in a book called The Oxford Project. You can see some of the pictures at our website, hereandnow.org, and photographer Peter Feldstein and longtime Oxford resident Kathy Tandy spoke to Here and Now's Robin Young about the book. Kathy makes donuts and lunches at the local depot. She and her husband and their four sons were photographed for the book. And in the 1984 photo, Kathy has shoulder-length, curly brown hair, and she's giggling. In the second photo, she's wearing glasses. She has shorter hair, and in the text that goes along with the new picture, she's very honest about some of the changes she's gone through over the years, especially her weight. So Robin asked her about that.
Well, I tell you, the story started in 1996. I have four wonderful sons who convinced their father that they should go shopping for an outfit for me for Christmas, but they couldn't find one big enough. And that kind of got me thinking, the day after Christmas, maybe I should do something about it. And I wanted to know how much I weighed. And at that time, Bob Cochran was running the sale barn in Oxford, and that's the only scales I could get on that would weigh me.
Oh, boy.
And I weighed in at a wonderful 432 pounds.
Okay.
So I called my doctor. She put me on a program, and we started with calorie counting. I tried all kinds of other things, but they didn't. You know, you lose weight, you gain weight. You lose weight, you gain weight. It's like a yo-yo system.
Well, and you know, and in a small town, I mean, you make donuts. You know,
yes,
everybody's
ma'am.
Got. Tell me some of the food in Oxford, because food is a big part of the life there. Everybody shares recipes. Everybody has the same, we understand, recipe for pie crust. Nobody knows where they got it. I mean, food's a big part of town.
It is. A lot of casseroles, a lot of high-calorie casseroles.
Yep.
Because we have farmers we have to feed. We have to give the guys something that's kind of stick-to-your-ribs kind of food.
Right.
The donuts, of course, are something everybody gets in the morning.
Yeah, you say that everybody used to call you the big girl in town. I mean,
yep.
You know, it sounds like affectionately,
yep.
But it's, you know, when you're in a small town and everybody sees you a certain way, how hard is that to sort of change that image?
It's hard. Then you change your image and you go out in public and you go someplace and they'll say, man, have you been sick? No, I haven't been sick. I've just been sick of being fat.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it was like all hands on deck. Let's cheer her on.
Well, yeah, you say the town was very supportive of you in your effort to lose weight.
They were. You know, people never ridiculed, or if they saw me eat something I probably shouldn't have, they never said, God, she's eating a cookie. They just walked up and said, hey, how's it going, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this is, Peter, this is what we sort of learn through the photographs. I mean, we also learn that, you know, Kathy's husband was called Gomer, and the kids say we were always Gomer's kids. Everybody knows everybody. Here you are, though, a native of New York who's moved to Oxford to become a photography professor at the University of Iowa. How did people feel about you?
You know, I don't know. I do know that during the project the first time, one of my students met somebody from Oxford, and they asked, what do they think of this guy? And the answer was, we think of him as a slightly eccentric man who talks to children and dogs. So.
Well, Kathy, was there that sense of there's something different about this guy?
Oh, yeah. You know, you come to a farming community where everybody's hair is short, and we wear blue jeans and work shirts. Here comes Peter bouncing into town. He's got a little bit longer hair, and he dresses a little different, and he talks a little different. But I think we've grown to kind of like him. Yeah. I think we'll keep him around.
Well, Peter, you say the one thing you grew to love about Oxford is if you're in trouble, people will help you no matter what. But it's also a place where people keep secrets. We learn in your book that Brianna Leckness was abandoned by her mom at a church when she was three. Her mom was with a carnival passing through town. And then there's Pat Henkelman. Now, she says in her interview that her husband of 45 years left her for another woman in town. Everyone else in Oxford knew it but her. This woman played euchre, the card game, with him at the Legion Hall. Kathy, were you one of those people who knew who Pat's husband was with? And what's that like to read that someone feels like everyone in town knows something she didn't know?
You know, sometimes they're always the last one to know. But yeah, I didn't know who it was. However, you're not going to go over there and say to Pat, hey, I know who your husband's running around with. I liked Pat. I liked her husband. So you're kind of protective. You kind of take her under your wing and say, I knew, but I didn't know how to tell you.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Kathy, did you find out anything in the book that you didn't know before?
Found something out about my own son.
Oh, what's that?
Robert, I didn't realize he thought he was the black sheep of the family.
Yeah, he says, I'm the black sheep of the family. I read everything I get my hands on. I went from science fiction to military history to superhero. I love Edgar Rice Burroughs. I still get a lot of grief for having a college degree.
Yeah, you know, he was the first one on both sides of our family to get a college degree in a couple generations. So, you know, I think he felt like he couldn't excel in what he would like to do. He knew he couldn't extend a career in Oxford. So when he went to college, he said, this is it, Mom. I'm going to get me a career. And when I get done, I'm going to have a job where I can work all day and not have to wash my hands to eat my supper. And he succeeded in doing just that.
He also tells an incredibly heartbreaking story about having an infant who died after 6 days.
Yes. Oh.
And
a
he writes.
A granddaughter.
Oh.
Yep.
And here's where, you know, a small town is just so wonderful because he says this little girl who lived 6 days got to meet everybody, you know, great-grandmas, grandparents. Is that where the town just sings for you?
Oh, yeah. You know, the first thing Bob did every time he had to get up and speak after Britton passed away, first thing he said, we are so humbled by our family and where we come from because regardless of when we see them, when we need them, they're always there. I don't care how long you're away from Oxford, but if you need us, we're always there.
That's Kathy Tandy, resident of Oxford, Iowa. She's one of the subjects in the book, The Oxford Project, which features photographs of Oxford residents taken in 1984 and 2005. Kathy and photographer Peter Feldstein spoke to Here and Now's Robin Young. We'll have more of that after a break. Plus, later in the show, could China breathe new life into U.S. automaker GM? Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Today we're revisiting a conversation Robin Young had earlier this year with Kathy Tandy and Peter Feldstein. Kathy is a longtime resident of Oxford, Iowa. Peter is a professor of photography at the University of Iowa. In 1984, he photographed Kathy and other Oxford residents for a project sponsored by the Iowa Arts Council. 2 decades later, he took new photos of them, and the side-by-side results were published in a book called The Oxford Project. Robin asked Peter, what jumped out at him in the then and now photos?
Well, I mean, the first thing you notice is how many people stand exactly the way they did 24 years ago, or how they're wearing the same clothes. Pat Henkelman is wearing identical shoes, the same with Don Saxton, the mayor, who wears his wristwatch up higher on his wrist than most people. In both photographs, he does that. He's also wearing a striped shirt in both. He's wearing the same kind of Sears or Penney's pants that are exactly the same.
What about the town? I mean, because there's also pictures of, you know, people having meals, farm stands. Mm-hmm. How has the town changed over 20 years?
The biggest change, I think, is that back in 1984, 80 to 90% of the people in town were born and raised there. But my guess is now that it's a lot less than that, that it might be 40 to 60%. One of the problems in Iowa is that the kids leave. So the population is quite a bit older than some of the other states. That's the biggest change. The town has picked up a bit. There's some businesses now that there weren't there then. Oxford, probably in the 50s through the 60s, had quite a number of businesses. And then it died when the Interstate 80 came through. But now some things are picking up again. There's a restaurant. And for many years, there were none except for the convenience store or the depot where Kathy works. And now there's a really nice restaurant, and you can't get in there without a reservation.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, how what the impact of that will be, because we read the average age of the town is 35, which is slightly higher than it was, and that there's very little diversity. There's one African-American living there. There were eight in 84. And, Peter, you photographed Jay Stratton, who's 23, who says, very bluntly, says, "I've never talked to a black person in my life. I don't have any trust with them. There's two kinds of blacks. There's the no-good kind, and then there's the white black. I don't agree with how they talk, the jibber-jabber. I don't like the baggy hip-hop clothes." And I'm just wondering, you know, while the town seems to have preserved so much, you know, storefronts and pie recipes, is it also maybe not in some ways moving on with the world? Or is Jay maybe not a good representation? I don't know.
I don't think he's a good representation, but I don't think he believes everything that he said, to be honest with you.
Well, Kathy, I'm wondering, too, if he's saying he doesn't like what he doesn't know. I mean, is there a little bit of that in Oxford, too, that if it's unfamiliar? I mean, we were reading in the page on the truisms, you know, the quirks of Oxford, that mm-hmm. if you live there 50 years but aren't born there, then you're not a local. So is that a part? Is there some of that, too, in Oxford? Just if it's not from there, it's by some people not understood.
Oh, yeah. My husband's a good example of that. If it's not something he's lived or experienced, he doesn't want anything to do with it. But I know JJ. I know Jay Stratton. And I've known him all of his life. And I know he regrets having said what he did because he didn't say it the way he wanted to. But he's just afraid that something new is going to come along. And I think change is a real fear for a lot of people in Oxford, especially the older people. Mm. They just don't want the change because they don't want to have to deal with it.
Well, and we see that in, again, this list of truisms. Collecting is a popular pastime, from lamps and figurines to tractors and engines. Many men won't leave home without a hat, a plier, or a pocket knife.
Oh, that's my husband.
That's a lot of guys.
Oh, yeah, a lot of husbands.
Yeah. Well, the truisms in the book include a lot of references to bars. Bar fights aren't a weekly occurrence, but neither are they infrequent. You know, I think, Kathy, I should ask you, you're familiar with the role of alcohol in a small town.
I am. My husband's a recovering alcoholic.
Does he have a lot of company in that? Or?
I think so. You know, we laughingly say Oxford's a drunk town. At one time, there were seven very, very productive bars in Oxford. And that was
during the late Prohibition.
50s, especially during Prohibition. Yeah. So, that's all there is to do in Oxford, is to go to the bar and have a drink, or maybe play cards and have another drink. So there's a lot of people that are probably in the same boat that I am that live with alcoholism. But, you know, it depends on what they do with it when they find out that they are an alcoholic.
Right.
If they are, they deal with it, then life is good, and ours is good.
You know, Robin, when I first moved to town, I saw three fights in one summer. And I think maybe I've seen two fights since. So Oxford had a reputation as being a tough town. I knew a guy in Iowa City who told me that when he was in high school, he and his friends would go out to Oxford to get drunk and get into fights. That was a regular Friday or Saturday night occurrence. It's not that way so much anymore.
No, it's not. We used to have such a reputation when I was in high school that the other small communities around us, we couldn't date those guys because they weren't allowed to date girls from Oxford. Yeah.
Well, we see the people of Oxford on display, and not just physically in the photographs, but all their thoughts in the text. as much as there is change, which we see, what I love is the people who were born and raised there and say things like Marty Gyres. He's pictured in 1984, just this, you know, kid with a big grin. And the quote is, "My mom and dad had four kids." I thought that was crazy. And then you open up the flap, and there he is with his four kids.
And if you notice a look of exasperation
yes.
on his face.
Kathy Tandy, longtime resident of Oxford, Iowa, who makes donuts and lunches at the local depot there, and is featured in Peter Feldstein's new book. He photographed nearly all of the residents of the town in 1984 and then did it again in 2005. The result is The Oxford Project, with pictures from Peter and text by Stephen Bloom. And Peter, you appear in the book, too, with pictures 20 years apart.
Yeah. There was one person in town that asked me who was going to take my photograph, and that was Hunter Tandy.
Kathy's son.
Yep.
He was 8 years old. He was the only person that asked me. He said, "Who's going to take your photograph?" And I said, "You are."
And he did.
And he did. Yeah.
Peter and Kathy, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Monday on Here and Now, regulating Wall Street. A former regulator wonders why Congress has put out the red carpet for business lobbies and shut out consumer groups as it considers new rules for financial markets. That's Monday. Still ahead today, GM in China. Back after the news, Here and Now. Stuff the bird, not yourself. That's the Thanksgiving Day advice offered by the Calorie Control Council. They're a trade group representing companies that sell low-calorie foods. And according to the group's research, the average American eats around 4,500 calories and more than 200 grams of fat at Thanksgiving dinner. Or, as one doctor put it, it's a, quote, tsunami of fat coming into the body. Well, maybe we relax just a little too much and lose our self-control at Thanksgiving. But there's new evidence that there could be a physiological reason why we eat so much, especially during the holidays. Well, we're joined by Susan Roberts. She's professor of nutrition at the USDA Nutrition Center at Tufts University. And Susan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So it's coming around next week, Thanksgiving, and I can already imagine the turkey itself, the stuffing, the green beans, the cranberry sauce, the everything. So tell us what happens to the body when we actually see and smell that gigantic spread of food.
You know, willpower really almost doesn't have anything to do with it. When you have a huge spread of food in front of you, you have an enormous physiological response. You have a surge of insulin, which drops blood glucose and makes you hungry. Your stomach muscles relax, and that means you have a bigger stomach that needs more food in it to feel equally full. The motion of your intestine increases so that you actually put that food away faster, you digest it quicker, and you're ready for a meal again. So it's not willpower. It really is how our bodies are supposed to work.
So just the sight and the smell of food prepares the body for a major onslaught of all of these different meals coming into the body at once.
Absolutely. You know, I think in evolutionary times, that was a great strategy. You know, you killed your bison, you ate a huge amount, you could eat it all before it went bad, and you had plenty of reserves in your body until you caught the next one. So in evolutionary terms, it makes complete sense.
So when I sit down to my Thanksgiving dinner and I've got my turkey and my stuffing, my body's ready to eat more, but even as soon as I take that first bite, the actual taste makes us consume more calories?
Absolutely. You know, the sight and the smell starts this whole process of a physiological drive to eat more, but then that first bite just amplifies it, and that's why you can't just eat one bite.
Do we have to be looking at a certain volume of food to trigger these responses? Because I'm not sure if I feel this way every time, you know, I'm just looking at my sandwich for lunch.
Well, I think it's a bunch of things. I mean, if you look at your sandwich, it doesn't trigger the same desire to eat it because it's the same as yesterday. Variety has an important effect. The perceived palatability of the food has an important effect. The amount of food also has a big effect. And that's why Thanksgiving meal has such a huge effect on how much we eat, because we have all those things rolled into one meal.
And so when you stuff your body full of food and you've got to unbuckle your belt a little bit, what's happening to the body later that day?
It's what scientists call the second meal effect. You have this enormous meal, and then the next morning, you feel unreasonably ready for a good breakfast. because it's one of those signals. When you've had this big meal, the last thing that happens is digestion is accelerated, and that means you're ready again sooner.
Ready again for maybe a turkey sandwich left over from the night before. The thing that I do wonder, though, is that if there's a physiological reason as to why we definitely overindulge on Thanksgiving, can I just kind of say, I know I'm going to overeat, my body's ready to do it, and willpower has nothing to do with it, so why bother to try and curb that overeating?
What we've been talking about is not being able to control the kind of cascade of biology that we have once it's activated. But you can do a lot to control the front end of the problem. So, for example, you don't have to go into Thanksgiving Day starving. If you go into Thanksgiving Day full, if you've had, you know, a cup of high-fiber cereal for breakfast, for example. I think that's one of the most effective things to do to control Thanksgiving Day eating, because if you're actually not hungry when you get to Thanksgiving Day meal, you can eat for enjoyment, and you always eat less if it's just for pleasure if you're not actually hungry at the same time. That's a huge way to cut calories.
Susan Roberts, professor of nutrition at the USDA Nutrition Center at Tufts University, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, in a moment, GM is a huge success in China, but can that success help get the U.S. automaker back on track? Back in 30 seconds, it's Here and Now. The car industry is still sputtering along in the U.S., and General Motors is still losing billions of dollars. And while car sales have dropped in the U.S. by 30%, they're booming in China. And GM car sales in China actually doubled in October versus sales a year ago. Kevin Whale is president of GM China, and he joins us from Shanghai. And Kevin, GM just posted third quarter losses of $1.2 billion. So how much is GM relying on China to help turn things around?
China sales are very important to everyone in the car industry, including General Motors. At the moment, it's the largest market in the world, and it's the one that's growing the fastest. But China alone isn't big enough to save anyone. We need to make sure that we get all of our businesses around the world, including the U.S., back on track.
So, Kevin Whale, let me ask you a little bit more detail about the business model that GM is running there in China. From what I understand, there's a government mandate that the company must form joint ventures with Chinese companies. So can you explain how that works?
Yeah, in order to compete in the Chinese market, 50% of the entity must be owned by our Chinese partners. Our partners are primarily a company called Shanghai Automotive Industry Corporation.
So in China, what are worker benefits there like?
They have healthcare programs that are partially borne by the company, partially borne by the government. They have retirement programs, and they have housing allowance programs. What they don't have is the build-up of utilization of that with an aging workforce and high healthcare costs.
So overall, it's a smaller economic burden for GM China than it is for General Motors in the United States?
That's correct. And obviously, our job is to make sure that we don't structure our business that these legacy costs become a significant part of our overall cost structure. So that's one of the things we need to manage, and one of the things we've learned from our experiences all around the world is that a lot of the employee benefit costs, such as pensions and healthcare costs, tend to build up in value over time if you don't manage them carefully. So we pay a lot of attention to making sure that we have programs that don't have a natural growth factor built into the design of the programs.
As we can see, you're describing a part of GM China's success there, you know, due to the country's manufacturing prowess. On that subject, we read that back in May, it was reported that GM had hoped to sell about 18,000 Chinese-made automobiles here in the United States in 2011. If these Chinese-made cars are exported to the United States, isn't there the chance you'll be displacing even more American workers?
No, we don't think that's going to happen. There was some discussion about potential export programs to the U.S., but at the moment, we're not considering those.
I read that your partner, your joint venture partner in China, Shanghai Automotive, is not only working with you, General Motors, but has launched its own brand as well. It seems a little ironic that they may be actually using General Motors' know-how to suddenly become your competitor in the Chinese market.
All China are encouraged by the government to develop their own brand as well as to share in joint venture activities with foreign-owned companies, and that's because they want to make sure that they have the capability to maintain an automotive industry in China under any circumstances. And we know that the market is growing rapidly and there's room enough for more than one competitor. So our job is to build up volume and brand equity in Chevrolet and Buick, and we'll make sure that our customers want to buy our cars rather than anyone else's cars, whether it's made by our partner or by some other company.
But isn't this a strange price to pay, that in order to play in the Chinese automotive market, you essentially have to educate your joint venture partners to become maybe not current serious competitors, but definitely future very serious competitors?
I don't think that's very different from anywhere else in the world. Wherever there's an opportunity for people to bring new knowledge into a country, the country where it is brought into obviously wants to have an ability to learn and grow from that.
Well, so GM China's operations there are definitely a rare bright spot in General Motors' overall health as a company. So what happens to GM's operations in China if the company ends up falling back into bankruptcy or dissolves here in America?
That's not going to happen, but our operations run as joint ventures over here. We're going to make sure that we continue to be successful in China, and I'm sure the rest of General Motors is going to be very successful for a long time to come.
Kevin Whale is president of GM China. Kevin Whale, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So that's the view from China. Now let's get the perspective from Detroit. Paul Eisenstein covers the automotive industry as publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. And Paul, Kevin Whale sounded very bullish about GM, but is the company out of the woods yet?
Oh my gosh, not even close. Interestingly enough, though, China will be one of the engines that could help turn things around.
And it could help turn things around not only in China, but globally and perhaps in the United States. And Kevin Whale, again from GM China, said that the company has no plans to export cars from China to the United States.
Well, for the moment, that appears to be the case. And I think that they know that there'd be some real political issues if they try to do that in the near term. So far, they've been operating there for, what, 10 years, and they have stuck to that word. Long term, it seems likely that they will export something from China, and one reason is that the market there is so darn large that they really don't need to export.
Well, Kevin Whale, again, of GM China, kept saying that, you know, one of the reasons why things are going so great for them there is that in terms of the Chinese workforce, GM does not have the what he kept calling excessive legacy costs. In other words, labor benefits, health benefits, retirement benefits.
Well, first of all, you've had such huge concessions here. You've had this employee health care program, which took a lot of the costs off of GM's books and so on. So the gap that way has narrowed significantly. We saw $1,000 or more just vanish in terms of labor costs as a result of the concessions given under bankruptcy.
Well, as we mentioned, the only way to get into the Chinese market is to form a joint venture with Chinese car companies. And now these joint ventures are starting to break off from GM and sell their own cars. So do you think GM now stands a chance of being pushed out of the market by the Chinese companies they helped build?
Simple answer, yes. GM is in a situation where, because it is forced to have a joint venture partner and because it is essentially subsidizing the learning curve for that company, it may eventually create a tremendous, tremendous competitor.
So Chinese competitors learning from GM in China. You're there in Detroit. What would you think that GM in America could learn from its own success in China?
It is setting up operational centers there. It just sent up a new technology and research center. And critical, it is using the Chinese to help develop the Buick brand. And if it didn't have the Chinese Buick brand to essentially help share costs, to develop product, and to subsidize some of the platforms that it uses, in other words, economies of scale, Buick might have vanished from the United States. So that's a very, very important thing that is paying off for General Motors here in the United States.
Paul Eisenstein with the DetroitBureau.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. It's Friday and time for sports, and here to talk about some of the highlights is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hey there, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
The International Track and Field Governing Body announced that 18-year-old South African Caster Semenya can keep the gold medal and prize money she won at the World Championship in August, but they didn't say whether she will be allowed to continue competing as a woman or disclose the results of a sex verification test she'd undergone. Thoughts?
Well, I've long been in favor of both privacy and civil rights, and so I think this is the right decision, especially since gender testing is arbitrary and capricious at best. Even the scientific experts acknowledge that. And I don't believe for a minute that this will remain private, because we live in a world in which nothing does.
So maybe ongoing doubts about Caster Semenya's gender, but in...
Leave her alone. Let her run. She's an entertainer. She's a runner. I think she has every right to do what she's been doing. She hasn't been trying to fool anybody.
But back in the United States, little doubt about football, because on Sunday, the New England Patriots take on the New York Jets, and whoa, still on the streets of Boston from last Sunday's ill-fated call by Pats coach Bill Belichick to go for a first down on 4th-and-2, hanging over the field. The nicest thing Pats fans are calling Belichick is stupid.
Well, that's, in fact, yes, the nicest thing. That is the nicest thing that I've heard.
Any chance the Pats can rebound?
Well, Jets-Pats, people would pay a lot of attention to Patriots-Jets anyway, and there is a growing suspicion among some fans that the whole thing last week was a publicity stunt to encourage even more interest in Pats-Jets. No, I'm kidding. It was the rare instance of the genius we know as Bill Belichick doing something incredibly stupid. Although if the guy had gone another 18 inches and gotten the first down, then Bill Belichick would have been a genius again, and everybody would have been sure that it was the smartest thing any coach had ever done.
And I'm sure acts of hubris have never been seen on the gridiron at Gillette Stadium,
and
of course.
And extreme judgments are completely foreign to the world of sports.
Well, on to the other form of football, soccer. It looks like David Beckham is finally pretending, maybe, as if he actually enjoys playing soccer in the United States.
Well, I don't know what he's pretending, but he has been good enough to help the Galaxy get to the final, and Major League Soccer couldn't be more delighted to have two of their brightest stars in their most important competition, David Beckham and Landon Donovan, playing together on the Galaxy. How soon we forget. Just a few short months ago, Landon Donovan was calling David Beckham a slacker and a fraud in the book about David Beckham that Grant Wall brought out. And even the commissioner, Don Garber, has said it didn't hurt a bit that there was turmoil in the Galaxy locker room before the season began, and it certainly isn't hurting a bit that the Galaxy is in the final.
So Beckham and Donovan on the pitch this weekend as Major League Soccer holds its final with the matchup between the Los Angeles Galaxy and Real Salt Lake. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And we leave you today with a story about another sport, one you may not be familiar with.
Still trying that deadbolt, just crossed 3 minutes. There's the deadbolt.
It's called lockpicking, but it's not about breaking and entering with criminal intent. It's a competitive sport with events like the Gringo Warrior held around the world.
We're ready, set, go. Working his cuffs in the side, boom, 5 seconds out of one side. Zam, not even 10 seconds out of both cuffs.
One of the fastest pickers lives here in the Boston area. Here and Now's Andrea Shea caught up with him and explains why his hobby can be serious business.
Nice. Now I can actually remove it.
As he manipulates a skinny pick to defeat a lock, Skylar Town wants to make one thing very clear. Real lock sporters abide by a strict code of ethics.
Never pick a lock you don't own, and never pick a lock that's in regular use.
Town owns a heap of locks, dozens made of brass and steel, stamped with common brand names like Master Lock and Yale, cover a table at this hackerspace in Somerville, Massachusetts. He's here building a lock library so people can study and conquer the device's tiny inner workings.
Every single one of these, 200-plus tiny puzzles here to be solved.
Like hackers, 25-year-old Town has an affinity for cracking security systems. For computer types, it's code. For him, it's mechanical tumblers and pins.
It's very tactile. It takes a lot of patience. It's the sort of thing that I like to do, down at the bar with some friends, having a beer and picking some locks.
It sounds pretty casual, but get Town talking about competing, and he amps up.
I pick low to mid security locks very, 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 very quickly. very quickly as I possibly can. I have my tools custom made so that I can pick locks faster. I practice obsessively so that I can pick locks faster.
Faster, so Town can beat his rivals in a handful of lock-picking contests each year. There's the Dutch Open in the Netherlands and a few others at hacker conventions such as DEF CON in Las Vegas. Skyler does well there. One year, he even gave a comprehensive lecture, Lock Sport, an Emerging Subculture.
In an ironic but not uncommon twist, I locked myself out of the hotel room this morning.
Of course, Town didn't pick that lock, but he's fully dedicated to spreading the word about lock sport. While competitive picking is accepted in countries such as Germany, it's still underground in the U.S. Town wants to change that.
Can you tell me in advance how many pins are in this?
Four pins?
In Somerville, Town has started a lock sport club. Six people show up for this meeting, including 27-year-old software engineer Andrew Gagne.
I mean, who doesn't like learning secrets, right? And that's what this is. You're learning a secret of how the lock works.
That's exactly what bothers Jim Pasco. He's executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, I'm unaware of any sport like let's pretend we robbed a bank or something of that nature.
Pasco's bemused by a sport based on skills usually associated with breaking and entering.
What I'd be concerned about is that it'd be a great place for a criminal or a would-be criminal to educate him or herself on how to gain access to premises not his or her own.
Fact is, explicitly detailed lockpicking videos are all over YouTube. And, as with computer hacking, there is a shady side to recreational picking. But some people in the security industry actually defend LockSport, because pickers, like hackers, can help reveal vulnerabilities.
It provides a platform, a test platform, and sort of an open critique of an idea.
John Lachlan is a mechanical engineer in New Jersey. He designs high-security locks and says when he finishes a new product, he lets locksporters take a whack at it first.
So that things can be changed and tweaked and improved before a product might go to production.
But most lock manufacturers are suspicious of LockSport, according to Skyler Town. He's used to that reaction, though. He says close friends and even relatives recoiled when he first confessed his passion for lockpicking about 3 years ago.
You have no idea the first time you open a lock, the prejudices, even the emotional connection to what a lock is supposed to be.
Town says it helps that his mother picks locks now, too. She's even sewed him a pretty little case for his custom-made tools. And now Town, a graphic designer by day, is working on marketing his own line of recreational picks. But what really keeps him in the game is the challenge and the thrill of trying to open any lock faster than anyone else.
Here and Now's Andrea Shea. To see photos of lock sporter Skyler Town and some of the tools he uses, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend. Don't forget your keys. And please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.